And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. It is Wednesday, October 27th, one game of the World Series in the books, and it was a win for Atlanta on the road. So we're going to dig into how they did it and the implications going forward in the series, because there were quite a bit of interesting things that happened that will impact the rest of this series. You know, Framber Valdez didn't have it, just catching too much of the plate, and Atlanta hitters were punishing him throughout the start. Jorge Soler hit the first leadoff home run in World Series history. I was surprised that hadn't happened before when they mentioned that during the broadcast.
Yeah, and like from Jason Stark's column, apparently Framber Valdez has not allowed a leadoff home run.
Naturally. So naturally he'd be the one that breaks the record.
Yeah, right. So well done all around. It was one of those emphatic, you're settling into your seat and you're kind of just like, you know, you're kind of like, oh, Jorge Soler is leading off. I wonder if that's like a matchups thing. Are they going to take him out of the game later? Like, why? You know, that's kind of a little bit weird. He's not the biggest OBP guy. You know, he's not fast. You know, it seems like a weird, oh my God.
That is not a good feeling when you're a fan of a team and you're at a game and they give up a leadoff home run or a
like
big
you're not probably not even in your seat, actually.
Haven't even taken a sip of your beer yet, and you're down 1-0. Like, that's a horrible feeling.
Yeah, and it didn't even really end there. Didn't they? They gave up another run with Albies getting on that infield single and getting around. So it was tough right from the beginning for them.
Yeah, and I think when you look back at how the Astros had the bases loaded when the bottom of the first inning ended, I mean, there was an opportunity for them to really change the flow of the game right away. They didn't do it. The big story, obviously, is Charlie Morton getting hurt. He got hit by a comebacker, suffered a broken fibula, so he is going to miss the rest of the postseason. I guess the good long-term news is he will be healthy for 2022, but this put Atlanta in a terrible spot because they had to rely even more on their bullpen in a situation where they shouldn't have had to rely on the bullpen much at all. AJ Minter came in, though, 2 2/3 innings, 43 pitches, 3 Ks, gave up 1 run, scattered 3 hits. I mean, that's a phenomenal performance for a guy that works much more often in a short relief role. I mean, that's a huge development for them, getting that sort of bridge from Morton to their other relievers in game one.
He's done this sort of thing before. I think I remember the bullpen game against the Dodgers, either this year or last year. Minter went two plus. So he has that kind of length in him, and he did used to be a starting pitcher like most relievers. But it was pretty amazing to see him pump in 96 all the way to the last out that he got. He was clutch. That was the big performance of the night, I think. Other than Morton getting 3 outs on the broken leg, which blew my mind. I mean, these guys are amazing, and Charlie Morton is just an absolute legend. It's tough on the Braves, though. You know, one way they can make it not meaningful is win a quick one.
Yeah, shorten up the series, and you'll be fine. I think it's easier said than done, of course. And, you know, looking through, Luke Jackson pitched well. Tyler Matzek, Astros got a run against Matzek. I mean, seeing all three of the lefties, Minter, Matzek, and Smith in game one, maybe that's a silver lining if you're Houston. And given how bad the start was for Framber Valdez, things could have been much worse for the Houston bullpen. They got 2 1/3 scoreless innings with 5 Ks from Jake Odorizzi. So that reduced a little bit of wear and tear on some of their better relievers, right? We didn't see Presley, we didn't see Graveman, we didn't see Javier. all of those guys. When you see Greinke, so you have all those options.
And everyone's available tomorrow for them too. I mean, even though Yimi Garcia, Phil Maton, and Ryan Stanek all threw about 20 pitches, like they're available tomorrow. I think the only one who's not available tomorrow, I mean, I think it'd be tough for AJ Minter to come back tomorrow.
Yeah.
If he comes back tomorrow, you already have like an out or two in the inning and there's a lefty up and you're hoping he doesn't even go three guys. You know, you're hoping he just finishes out the inning. I feel like, I think they'd rather stay away from him tonight. And I think, you know, those two things are meaningful because, you know, Minter's, you know, one of their best three relievers. So if he's not available tonight, and Morton's not available going forward, that, you know, those are significant setbacks for the Braves. They need their starting pitcher to go deep tonight in order to, you know, deal with the fact that they may not have any Minter.
Yeah. So we'll get to game two here in just a few minutes, but a few opportunities for Houston to kind of claw their way back into this game. They just couldn't do it. Atlanta's defense held up really well again. Overall, there were a couple moments where you thought maybe things were going to break, but it was really more of a bend, not break sort of performance on that side. Came through when they had to. Thinking about replacing Charlie Morton on the roster, since they know he's not coming back for the series, they can bring somebody else in. Tuki Toussaint, Josh Tomlin, Spencer Strider, I think were among the names that I saw as possible options. Who would you go with to replace Morton on the Atlanta roster?
I bet they go with Tuki just because he's been around longer. But I think Strider might actually be the move because Strider has some length. And then also nobody's seen him, you know. I mean, you can develop a scouting report. I think one thing that's happening in today's game is that the scouting reports on, you know, debuts and rookies are more advanced than they used to be. That's partially because of TrackMan, partially because teams have, you know, huge scouting departments and the ability to invest this sort of time into making sure they know about everybody on the way up. But I still think that's different than like sort of standing in the box against a guy, which nobody on these Astros would have stood against Spencer Strider.
Yeah, I think with Strider, the element of surprise could be huge. You can get the better scouting report on Tuki. You can see what opposing teams have done in their approach against him that has worked, and maybe you can build something a little more effective based on that. Kyle Muller also suggested by Todd in the live stream if he's been throwing. I think that's the other question people have is, you know, what are the pitchers who are not on the roster but on the taxi squad doing to stay fresh? How do they pace out their throw days to remain in a position to come in and possibly offer length? I mean, you mentioned Strider being more stretched out. Is he throwing long bullpens every few days? I mean, I imagine each team has a group of relievers they're trying to keep stretched out, and they got a bunch of starters that are working like starters, and they got a few relievers that are just ready to come in and gobble up an inning or two at a time. But it's one of those things that is definitely more of a mystery because we don't get to see it.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think I would assume something like, three or four days before the series starts, they throw like a sort of a simulated game that's almost like a full game, right? Because then you could bring them in at any time in the first sort of 3, 4, 5 days of the new series, and they'd still kind of be stretched out. So you'd kind of want, to get the work in as soon as possible, so that you'd be rested by the time they need you.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to do anything during the series because then, oh man, he just threw yesterday.
Right. Well, beyond like a regular throw day sort of thing, just a 15 pitches, whatever, like something simple like that, just to.
And you may save that. You may even save that sort of 15 pitch throw day for a day in which a starter went long, right?
Right. You could kind of see what happened in the game and then throw late in the evening.
Ian Anderson went 7 a day. Quick, you know, Muller, go throw 20 pitches or whatever.
Turn the lights on at the backyard. Go throw.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if it's quite like that, but it's fun to imagine what it could be like. Any other takeaways for you from game one? I mean, I think it's...
I do know something from the Arizona Fall League that's somewhat relevant, is that I think that the taxi squad, the sort of guys that could be available, are somewhere together. Shea Langeliers did not show up at the Arizona Fall League, because he is basically the emergency catcher if people get hurt. So he didn't want to be playing in Arizona, be harder to get to or get hurt in Arizona. So he's somewhere with the rest of the taxi squad guys. So you, if you have a catcher, you know, you have someone to throw to. So I'm sure they're all in a hotel somewhere in Houston or Atlanta, you know, kind of, you know, getting their directives from the coaching staff.
I was wondering last night, I know Jason Castro entered the game as a replacement for Maldonado. There was a situation, it was lefty-lefty, it must have been in the ninth inning against Will Smith, where they let Castro hit and they were down four. Like, what are you doing? Like, I mean, you might as well just play for the tie, and if you do tie it up, like, go to your emergency catcher, go to someone on your bench that can handle it, right? Because at least then you're not taking a bad lefty-lefty matchup at a time where you just need runs. You're desperately in need of runs, and it doesn't matter if you've already used your other catcher. Someone else can do the job. Identifying that player, I know, is tricky, and in playoff games especially, where you're trying to get every optimal matchup possible, you may have already burnt the backup catcher as a pinch hitter. That's entirely possible. I don't think that was the case last night necessarily, unless Aledmys Diaz is that player for Houston. But that struck me as a little bit of an odd sort of thing where it's like, hey, you should be pushing all your chips in right now. You're down four.
Yeah, you know, teams are, I think that's one of the more conservative spots on even the most progressive teams is, you know, identifying a third catcher and not touching them, leaving the last guy on the bench will be the third catcher, that sort of deal. You know, nobody really wants, because I think you just get hurt, that the player gets hurt a lot. Like if you put, who'd you put back there? Like, who could it be? Like, you put Yuli Gurriel back there because he may be caught like 20 years ago. You know what I mean? And then you hurt Yuli Gurriel because he forgot how to catch, you know? And like, you know, then you've hurt a guy going forward. And how much did you help your chances in the game? And I don't know. I remember being like, Castro's the guy in this moment.
Yeah, it was the bottom of the ninth. Any other situation, you can't do it. But I think in that exact situation, the very remote possibility of tying the game and not just, you know, winning it outright, potentially in the bottom of the ninth, mm-hmm. if you do even rally, in that unlikely event, you'd take your chances with, you know, Marwin Gonzalez or whoever it was on your bench who is put on catcher's gear, even as a joke last, and say, well, hey, we're just happy to be here. So let's just try to find a way to get it done. Let's take a look ahead to game two. It's going to be
massive. I did want to say one thing about game one. You know, I've talked about this a little bit on the podcast before, but so Framber Valdez and Jose Urquidy had something in common in their bad starts, which is they were both about two ticks up, you know, a tick and a half to two ticks up in terms of velocity. And so both those guys, you know, their location scores are better than their stuff scores, or their command is better than their stuff. And so it reminded me of a thing that John Smoltz said a long time ago, which was that he thought he was the best Braves guy out of the top of the big three in the postseason because he was more of a stuff guy. He didn't have the command of Glavin and Maddux. And so when he got to the postseason, he was able to throw harder, and he was a guy who relied on his stuff anyway. So it was just stuff plus. And so, you know, he thought that Maddux and Glavin had a little bit more adjustments to make in the postseason, because if they are going to throw harder, then the ball is going to move differently. And if you saw last night, Valdez, his curveball moved 3 inches less horizontally than his average this year, and his sinker dropped 3 inches less than it did during the regular season. And so, if you're that 3 inches is pretty significant for a pitch. I mean, that's a big difference. And so, you know, I think he was just struggling to figure out where he could put the ball with this new movement. You know, I think he did want to throw 96. I mean, that's good. You want to throw 96, but you also need to hit your spots. So I think that's a lesson for Urquidy tonight. I don't know whether the idea is just to like throw free and easy and don't worry about the velo, or to make adjustments quicker when you start noticing that you're missing your spot by 3 inches because the movement was different. So then you have to set your sights quicker. You have to change your game plan. that's what I was yelling about, sort of like maybe they should have done the front door curveballs, front door breaking balls in Urquidy's last start to just, you know, get one that landed in the zone, you know. But in any case, I'm sort of really interested to see what, and this could be our transition, get on the segues. I'm really interested to see Urquidy, his command and his velocity tonight.
I was just thinking about it from the perspective of the Adam Duvall home run, where it was a down and in curveball that he just teed up. It was in the zone. It was a hittable pitch for sure. But if you have less
probably
movement,
should have
than
been
you expect,
more back foot. And
yeah,
should have been
like in more on his hands and much harder to drive that pitch
than it actually was. Maybe. Three inches in, maybe.
Yeah, because I mean, I just saw that pitch location. I was like, okay, the first pitch that he threw to Soler that got hit out, or it was the third pitch of the sequence. But that fastball was a garbage fastball. You just missed
a
spot. That was a BP fastball.
That was like a huge miss. That wasn't a 3-inch thing. But there were some 3-inch misses where he didn't get the call, got into bad counts, or gave up a homer because of it.
Yeah, I think that Duvall home run might be a really good example of the cost of missing a few inches of movement for Framber Valdez in that start in game one. But yeah, game two, Max Fried against Jose Urquidy. It's an 8:09 first pitch, still on Fox. Whole series is on Fox. You don't have to jump around from channel to channel. So good for those of you who just turn the TV
TBS.
Then turn it off. Yeah, find TV. It's not like March Madness when you find Court TV for the one time, or True TV for the one time every year. Do I get this channel? What other packages do I have to add to get this one game that I'm going to watch for 8 minutes while I shuffle around from channel to channel? It really depends on if your team is playing on that channel or not.
Cable's last dying gasp.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
I don't feel any better off than I did 10 years ago with what
we have 8 million streaming things. I think we might be paying for Disney Plus twice. We can't find it.
I'm getting a burrito and a piece of pizza and some french fries and a milkshake and a cheeseburger,
and they're each $30 each.
Right, it's just overindulging and overpaying along the way. But Fried versus Urquidy, a matchup that I would say, you know, favors Atlanta. You and I like Jose Urquidy. We've discussed him a lot over the life of this podcast. I thought it was a little bit interesting that they chose to go with Urquidy over Garcia in this spot. I think part of the concern was prolonged rest again for Urquidy. They thought maybe rust was a factor in why he struggled in that last start that he made against the Red Sox. And I think the other variable here is outfield defense. You know, having to play with Yordan in the outfield in game three in Atlanta changes a little bit about which pitcher you might want to. But I think it's probably more like 80-20 rest factor probably kicking in to push Urquidy out there for two as opposed to Luis Garcia.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, they mentioned the fact that Garcia was throwing I-7 in this last start. So I guess they're wanting to give him more rest so that maybe they can get another game with 97s out there, right? I picked the Astros. It was one of those things where I was like, man, I love Jose Urquidy. My name has been attached to Jose Urquidy's this year. I might as well just go all in. if I pick the Braves and Urquidy beats them tonight, then that would just be sad. <You know? laughs> The Zips odds are 51-49.
Well, that's interesting because the money line today is -115 for Houston, -105 for Atlanta. So that's very similar.
Yeah. So it's about as close as you get to pick them, because I think that's all home field advantage, right? That's about, I think home field advantage is like sort of 51-52%. In fact, it might be Braves favored if it was on a neutral site.
Yeah, okay. I could level with that.
So
how is it going to be different for Urquidy this time out versus the last time we saw him against the Red Sox?
Luis Garcia had the biggest stuff differences home and away. Urquidy has a little bit of that. His stuff has been better at home. I think there's just the knowledge that his stuff is playing differently, that he, you know, like there's just the knowledge of what happened last time he pitched at this sort of amped level, which, you know, there isn't any evidence statistically that playoff experience matters. And I think that's just because there's a ton of noise, but in terms of like what it's like to be a player in it and to be a coach in it, I have to think that it does matter to some extent. And this is going to be the time that it matters, because Jose Urquidy came out there and was like, whoa, like, you know, I'm throwing harder and the pitches aren't doing what they normally do. And what do I do? This time he's going to be like, oh crap, I'm throwing harder and the pitches aren't doing what they normally do. Like, at least we've been thinking about this for the last week.
Yeah, I wonder.
I'm not such a numbers geek that like I say, oh, the numbers say that playoff experience doesn't matter, so nothing different is going to happen tonight. I don't think that's true either. Like, we are human beings. He spent a week thinking about what happened last time out.
Sure. And I think it could be something on the margins. It could be something where the effect of being on the road with less experience is greater than being at home, right? That there's a greater negative impact of being on the road as a young player than there is a positive impact from being at home.
I think there's part of that. You know, Urquidy's a big fly ball pitcher. They also didn't want to have Alvarez out there, you know, defending when Urquidy's throwing. And then Garcia has just thrown more this postseason. So I think that speaks to what you're talking about. Like, he's just like been in the Lions den more.
But all that being said, the appearance, game three of the ALCS, was Urquidy's fifth career postseason appearance on the road. So it, I don't know, like, how long does it take to get comfortable in those spots?
I think it's less that like people were yelling at him and stuff, and more that, like, you know, he was just like, what do I do with this movement,
right,
in this velo?
I would be more inclined to buy that sort of explanation for his struggles than just the road as a sort of vague explanation. For Fried, thinking about this Houston lineup, the damage they do, I'm wondering, what's his best path to be successful against this group of hitters?
I think he has to be able to place his fastball, his curveball and slider in the bottom of the zone. So I think about Bregman and Correa are both, and actually Altuve, all three of those guys are high ball hitters. And they are high ball right-handed hitters that basically spit on low pitches. Altuve is slightly different because he and Otani had the biggest difference between their highest home run and their lowest home run, which is kind of amazing if you think of Altuve's size compared to Otani's. Otani is somebody that you'd figure would have that large of a difference, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's just so tall and big. But Altuve had the second largest difference, and that means he was hitting something at his eyeballs and something at his toes to keep up with Otani. But in any case, Altuve might be the hero of game two, but Fried, in order to silence the rest of the lineup, has to be able to basically place that slider and curveball in the zone to frustrate Bregman and Correa, who will mostly spit on those pitches and not swing at them.
Yeah, you got to get those called strikes that Houston hitters simply don't want to swing at. And avoiding mistakes with the fastball is probably a rubric for some success for any pitcher against any team. But I think with Fried specifically, that's the pitch where hitters can do the most damage. When that fastball leaks out over the plate, he gets hit, and he can get hit pretty hard. So I think that's the other thing I'm looking for from him, is that he's locating the fastball with kind of pinpoint command. If he's doing that, it could be a long night for Houston.
And for Bregman and Correa, they're actually pretty similar hitters. For him, that, like, if he has to throw the fastball high, he better do it out, actually, like, out over the plate, like, sort of outside corner and high. Because Bregman and Correa both have created this swing that's crazy, that up and in is a strength for them. Did you see that Correa homer in the White Sox game?
I did. I'm trying to remember it.
Rodon?
Yeah.
It was up and in, and it made me, like, look up his heat map, and I was like, holy crap, Correa, like, wallops up and in. I don't know. Once he identifies that's coming, there's some mechanical thing where he gets his hand through real quick and just tomahawks it. If Fried misses with the fastball up and in, that's going to be tough for him. So the big thing for him, I think, is maybe a combo of high fastballs away, and then maybe some more curveballs to those guys. Because he could throw a curveball, like a backdoor curveball that was ball, strike. You know, and I think that might play off of a high fastball away, right? If everything's like high and away,
Fried's fastball chart.
Looking at the catcher, right?
Yeah.
See, that's a little problematic for me.
Yeah,
right.
Up and away is where you want it, and he's usually in on the hands and in over the plate a little too much too.
Correa and Bregman can hit those.
Yeah.
So that's he's gonna have to go away from his strengths a little bit. Thank you for that heat map. That was great.
Yeah. Well, hey, I was thinking on the fly for once.
but he'll have to go away from his strengths a little bit. He'll have to be really careful about his four seam, I think. Have to place those breaking balls in the zone against the lefties. I don't know, man, that slider just running away from lefties is going to be really rough. I would expect Brantley and Yordan Alvarez to get some walks, but not necessarily hit the ball hard.
Yeah, as great as Fried has been throughout the second half and for most of the postseason, this could be the most difficult test he's faced yet, because the Astros, of course, had the best offense in the league throughout the season. So, there
and
you go.
Better is it? No, not better righties than Dodgers. Dodgers were lacking the lefties a little bit.
Yeah, I mean it's comparable. Like I just look at this Houston team, and I know they're not going to be quiet offensively for long. Even the fact they were scratching out runs against some of the Braves' lefty relievers. To me, that's the silver lining. That's the thing
and
you should be a little
contact.
Bit excited about. Yeah, they're putting pressure on them. I mean, that's huge, and that's going to be the constant test on Atlanta's defense, which is much improved with all the shifting. It's light years ahead of where it was earlier in the season, but the outfield defense in particular, I think that's going to come back to bite Atlanta at some point in this series. It has to.
Yeah. It's just, in today's game, like, sometimes there's just fewer balls in play. I mean, there's definitely teams that are kind of making a bet on the fact that there's fewer balls in play so we can get away with worse defenders out there.
Absolutely. As James points out in the live stream, sounds like a tough matchup for Fried, not just because the Astros are so good, but because his strengths play into their strengths. Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I think there's a little bit of that going on with Fried, but should be an exciting game too. Any other thoughts on your mind here as we think about how this one might play out?
No, the one thing that's interesting is that Urquidy is a changeup first guy. I mean, he's brought his breaking balls along. And interestingly enough, Urquidy, Garcia, Javier, and maybe even McCullers throw basically that seam shifted wake slider that I wrote about with the Dodgers. They throw what's called a sweeper. It's a seam shifted wake slider that drops a little bit less than you'd expect. I think it looks a little bit like a curveball, and then it has more horizontal movement than drop. And it doesn't go as hard. It's usually a mid-80s pitch. But as far as they've engineered the breaking balls for Urquidy, the changeup is his best pitch. And it's just an interesting thing. I think we've gone away from the changeup as a sport because there are too many times that it just allows contact. It's, you know, if you throw it, you know, a two-strike changeup, I think a lot of times hitters are expecting it. And a lot of what the changeup does for you is be unexpected. So it's interesting to me that the sport has kind of gone away from it. Who else in this entire series has a plus changeup? I mean, Greinke has that power change.
Yeah, that's probably
the only one that comes to mind for me right now. So interesting to see that. Ron Washington has been interesting to me. Todd Rankinmeyer, he's that was interesting, but also some of Ron Washington's sends have been really interesting. And one thing that he said when they interviewed him that I thought was interesting was that he's not worried about the next hitter. He doesn't think, you know, I should stop this guy because Freeman is up next. He tries to only appraise the situation as it is.
That makes sense.
You know, I think that, yeah, it's like mental clutter, right? It's like,
right, because you'd almost certainly do the math wrong in your head, like anyone would. Like,
yeah,
oh, wait, Freeman's like, oh, up Freeman instead of Soler. Yeah.
Freeman will hit him in, of course. Freeman will get the RBI, and then yeah. Freeman strikes out, and you're like, ah, dang it.
Yeah, much more sound approach to just make the decision based on the actual play as it's developing, as opposed to thinking about the next thing in this instance.
Yeah, and I was really impressed with Ron Washington. Also got interviewed. They asked him about the defensive changes they made. Mike Petriello had a great article about how they changed in the middle of the season. And he said that the Alex Anthopoulos and the brass came to him and said, you know, we want to do more shifting. What do you think? And he's like, they said, well, what if we do it in a week or something? And you prepared for it. And he goes, why do it in a week? We should do it right now, and then in a week from now, we'll have all the kinks out. We can have another meeting, and we can, you know, talk about it then. I liked a lot of things about that. One is, just do it, you know. Two is, after a week, they brought the concerns of the players back to the front office and to the manager and to the people who wanted to implement it. So that shows a little bit of a two-way street. It's like, we're not just going to implement this and shove it down your throat. You know, we're gonna try it because we want to win. And we ask you, you're in, okay, you're in. And then we want to ask you, what's your opinion? What do you think so far? And you have to be careful about like implementing every single thing, because they'll remember, oh, that one time we shifted and the ball went through. And so I hate the shit. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah. There've been plenty of pitchers that have talked about that.
But I think that players are smart enough to realize this is about the sum of things. And you know, they may just have feedback on a much smaller level, which is like, you know, give me the power to take a step or two in a direction based on my intuition. And then I'm cool with these charts. You know what I mean? And we've seen that a step or two in the right direction can be huge. And that's why, you know, there's been some charts out there about like, oh, who shifts the most against righties and lefties and all this. And a lot of people are like, why don't we shift more against righties? One reason is the first baseman has to cover first. So you just have a little bit less flexibility there. And then two, I think, is that there are some teams that are doing little micro shifts. They're doing smaller things that don't show up in Savant as a quote unquote shift with a capital S. And that's something we saw even with the Braves, where Dansby Swanson was, you know, took two steps towards the bag and was standing in a place that he never stood in 2020. You know, that's as important as the big, you know, let's put the second baseman in right field shift.
Yeah, I was thinking about the right-handed shifts too. Maybe there's some way, at least with some pitchers, to have pitchers just cover first base in those situations.
Yes, yes, yes. I've asked pitchers about this.
How much do they hate it?
They didn't like it.
Yeah, I kind of figured they'd hate that.
They didn't like it. But I think it might work, and I think it'd be maybe one thing to ask some of the older pitchers, although Greinke would love it, I think. Greinke always wanted to be a shortstop, right? So
yeah.
Hell yeah, I can make it over there.
Oh, yeah. I'll start running this before the pitch even is out of my hand. I'll be halfway there.
But some of those like relievers that have like crazy fall off the mound stuff, you know, they'd have to like pick themselves up and then run over there.
Yeah. Yeah, that would not be ideal. So predictions for game two. Do you think the Astros draw level? I mean, it has to kind of play out that way unless it's going to be four in a row if our series predictions are going to come to fruition.
I'm saying that the offense breaks out.
Yeah, like a 6-7 run performance from Houston's offense.
I think so. And even if it's not all against Fried, like, you know, two or three against Fried, you know, push him out. No Minter, I don't think.
No, there's no way Minter's pitching today.
Right? I don't think so. So if you push Fried out in the, you know, fourth or fifth, then, you know, here comes Jackson or, you know, somebody else before you even get to Smith and Matzek, right? I mean, you're not going to get four innings from Smith and Matzek. So there's a couple opportunities there for them to Vincent wants an update on the keg. I did some work on it last night. I think I pushed past halfway.
You passed the halfway mark.
I really need Derek to come over.
What beer do you think I can drink?
I don't know, but it's more than just me alone.
Yes, that's true.
I've invited friends over for Saturday night as well. Got to go re-up on the ice today. Still, the good news is it's still cold. So the outside is still cold, and the beer is still cold. So my wife had one last night. It's like one of those almost like cryo dust IPAs where it's got a little bit of a what I call a vegetable burn, where they've taken the hops and like distilled it down to like a powder and put it in. She was like, "I'm not helping you."
I like that beer. I actually thought that beer was pretty accessible for people who don't even like IPAs as much, just because it's a little more of the juicy side.
Yeah, I mean, it is juicy, but it has a little bit. It's a double dry hopped one. I don't know if you had the double dry hopped one, but yeah.
Yeah, that was the one I had the crowler of. I loved it, but my palate's not a normal palate necessarily.
No, I mean, my wife just, it's a little unpredictable for me. She likes hazies, but not all of them. So just not, she wasn't going to have this one. And James is right. she's gonna tap the watch pretty soon, I think.
Sunday. I think Sunday is your day where you're gonna be asked to remove the keg from the yard.
It does it has made me think about the desert island construct of like, what's your desert island beer? Because I have been drinking one beer now. One beer for a week. Not quite a week, sort of 5 days. And I like it. I still like it. But I could see a sunset coming.
Yeah. Where
I have opened my beer fridge to get the ice out and looked at my beer and been like, yeah, I have other beer.
What's the temperature on this island? I think that might be a factor in this decision,
right? Yeah. Yeah, it might just be Corona if it's super hot.
I appreciate Vincent chiming in to ask the hard-hitting questions today, because I think everyone's on keg watch. They want to know if Eno can finish half a keg by himself between now and Sunday, or at least with the help of a few friends along the way, because that's a tall order. If you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, this is a great time to get one with all the great playoff coverage up right now. Get 33% off at theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels. More coverage on the Mets' ongoing pursuit of a new GM. Matt Arnold withdrew his name from consideration before we started recording today. I thought that might actually work, but nope. He knows.
An executive saw a tweet stream that I was having where people were defending Sandy and Brynn and saying that wasn't a big deal. And, you know, I had some sort of vendetta, or I wanted to cancel Sandy. Like, none of those things are true. But an executive saw that, and one I hadn't talked to yet, and was like, "Oh, by the way, I rejected an offer from the Mets for an executive position because of the Sandy Brynn situation."
Yeah, so there you have it. So more on that story to come. Whee! Among many, many other things.
Oh, and you know, these stands are going to come in there and be like, "Well, you know, permission." Listen, permission is a thing, But if you're offering director of baseball operations to a GM, permission, you're supposed to give permission. It's a little different if you're trying to get Stearns, right? Because Stearns is a president of baseball operations, right? So you're offering a president of baseball operations and Milwaukee would be like, he's not even getting a raise or a promotion. So no, you can't talk to him. But like if you call and say, well, what about your GM? They're supposed to say, yes, you can talk to him. And so the wording today out of Adam McAlvey was that he withdrew his name from consideration. So I don't, you know, you have to do some mental gymnastics to be like, oh, that's just the Brewers.
I don't think so. I think that's just the person saying, stop calling me. Job. I'm going to take a different job later. Like I have a good job now. I'm going to get a better job than the one you're offering me when the next group of vacancies comes around.
And honestly, I think like in a year, you know, I just think people are like, well, you know, Sandy's only going to be there for a year and you can fire Brynn. Yeah, but people don't want like, part of the job is firing. Like part of the job is firing, but you don't want to already know they have to fire people. You know what I mean?
You want to show up the first week and start firing people at your new job?
Right. So then that means you got to work with Sandy and Brynn for a year before you can get rid of them. And they may obfuscate what you're trying to do, or it'd just be awkward. And you're just like, anybody who takes a job is going to at least be like, oh, for a year, it's going to be super awkward.
Yeah. Not ideal. So, you know, if you got a good thing going, keep the good thing, choose a better thing when the time comes around.
And the list is so long now, dude. I mean, you could try and be like, well, Theo is doing this and do. But the thing is, the list of people who said no is Bendix, Josh Burns, Brandon Gomes, dude. Brandon Gomes was playing like 3 years ago. Theo, I mean, Arnold. We're at like eight people who've said no.
Billy Bean.
And yeah, you could be like, well, Billy, the children. Yes, every one of them said something because it's rude. Nobody wants to come out there and be like, you know, this is exactly, no one's ever going to be like, this is exactly publicly. This is exactly why I'm not taking this job. Like no one would be like people told me all the time, I'm not taking a job with the Angels, right? I've never taken a job with the Angels because of Artie Moreno. Yeah, I've heard that from like 3-4 people. I heard that from one person who literally declined a GM interview and it would have been his first GM job. And he said no because of Artie Moreno. Have you ever heard someone say that publicly?
No, of course not.
Why would you ever say that publicly? So why would you ever say publicly, no, I didn't take the job because Sandy's there? That'd be crazy. Nobody does that. So you have to read between the lines a little bit. And right now, with like 8 rejections. So, and then someone's going to come in and be like, oh, look who they got in the end. They must like, you know, aren't you going to say they're wrong? Somebody wanted to work with Sandy. I'm like, yeah. Their 10th guy. Really, really the 10th option.
Yeah. This is like when Dan Duquette got the Orioles job a few years back, that was the other job. That was the job no one wanted at the time. It just bounced around and bounced around and bounced around. And finally it was, okay, Dan Duquette will work with Peter Angelos.
Situation too. Mm-hmm. I think there might be some evidence that ownership has eased up off of it. Like, for example, I think ownership was kind of anti, they've even said some stuff where like they're anti-international signings for a long time. And remember the Orioles like didn't make international signings for a long time?
Yeah, for years they had no presence there.
And then Elias went in and like, you know, started changing that. So there's some stepping off there. But I think that like, you know, Perryman Asian, you know, he's fine. In fact, I like some of the stuff he's doing with the Angels right now. They just signed Connor Hinchcliffe from Driveline and I don't know if it's public, but another they've hired a couple of names where I was like, okay, they're getting serious about pitch design. So I like that. But I also think that Perryman Asian wasn't really on anyone's like short list and was a bit of a surprise pick. And I think Artie Moreno is part of that.
Totally makes sense. You know, he is the ultimate boss in that organization as the owner. We are going to go. We are back tomorrow at 11:30 a.m. Eastern. Give us a follow on Twitter. He's at Enoceris. I am at Derek Van Riper. You should follow Britt, even though she's not here today, at Britt_Giroli. And be sure to barrel up on the like button if you're watching us on YouTube. That is going to do it for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We are back with you on Thursday.
Thanks for listening.